Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest shooting at Fort Hood, Texas, that has left four people dead, including the gunman, and 16 others wounded, three of whom are critical. Joining us is Kayla Williams, the author of a new book about dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, from military service in Iraq. Plenty of Time When We Get Home, Love and Recovery in the Aftermath of War. She served in the U.S. Army for 5 years as an Arab linguist, including a year in Iraq with the 101st Airborne Division. And we will discuss this tragedy and its impact on military families, as well as examine the links, if any, between violence and PTSD. Then we'll examine the details of the Supreme Court ruling overturning limits on campaign funding in McCutcheon versus the FEC with Jessica Levinson, a professor at Loyola Law School, who has an article at the Los Angeles Times, Supreme Court Ruling, As If We Don't Have Enough Money in Politics Already. We will discuss what partisan advantage might come out of the ruling in this case that was brought to the Supreme Court by the Republican National Committee and assess how many average citizens in this country can afford to give the low end $5,200 to a candidate, let alone the millions now allowed to candidates, parties, and political committees. Then finally, with the American who spied for Israel, Jonathan Pollard, now at the center of a storm over who is scuttling the Israeli-Palestinian peace talks, we will speak with M.E. Spike Bowman. He was, at the time of Pollard's arrest and trial, the liaison officer for the Department of Defense to the Department of Justice and the coordinator of an investigation into the extent of Pollard's damage to the American intelligence community. We will discuss comparisons of Edward Snowden with Jonathan Pollard and why it is that Pollard is a hero in Israel. And joining us now is Kayla Williams, who served in the United States Army for 5 years as an Arab linguist, including a year in Iraq with the 101st Airborne Division. She is a member of the Army Education Advisory Committee, a fellow with the Truman National Security Project, and a former member of the VA Advisory Committee on Women Veterans. Her books include Love My Rifle More Than You, Young and Female in the U.S. Army, and her latest just out is Plenty of Time When We Get Home, Love and Recovery in the Aftermath of War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kayla Williams.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
And this latest shooting in Fort Hood, Texas, by a soldier who killed three people and wounded 16 others before committing suicide. Apparently three of the 16 are in critical conditions. And ironically, of course, he bought his 45 caliber handgun at Guns Galore, the very same gun shop where the Fort Hood killer, Major Nadel Hassan, purchased the firearm which he used to kill 13 people back in 2009. So obviously this is a horrible trauma for this already traumatized military base, but the issue of PTSD is coming up in all of the press reports. And your book, your latest book, Plenty of Time When We Get Home, Love and Recovery in the Aftermath of War, is about dealing with PTSD. In this case, it was your husband who was severely wounded in Iraq, and he had a long recovery. And this is a very powerful and intimate portrait of what it's like for a family to deal with this issue. What do we know about PTSD in this case of this shooter whose name is Ivan Lopez?
Well, I don't know anything on a personal level. All I know about this particular individual is what's been in the popular press. And what I've seen and heard so far is that he was getting treatment for some sort of mental health conditions, possibly including depression, and that he was being evaluated for PTSD. But my understanding from what's been released to the media so far is that he did not have a specific PTSD diagnosis. And I do think it is worth noting that the link between PTSD and violence is weak. There is some evidence that people with PTSD are more likely to engage in kind of impulsive aggression, maybe intimate partner violence, but the type of premeditated and extreme cases of violence like what we witnessed yesterday, that is not linked to PTSD. And so I really want to urge people to not develop some, you know, deep fear that all veterans are I've seen headlines as bad as ticking time bombs, and want to remind people that overall, in fact, all people with mental health conditions are more likely to be the victims of violence than the perpetrators of violence.
So according to the Army Secretary, John McHugh, Ivan Lopez served for 4 months as a truck driver in Iraq in 2011. That was after most of the combat was over. And his records show no wounds, no direct involvement in combat, or any injury that might lead us to further investigate battle-related TBI, traumatic brain injury. But nevertheless, Lopez apparently self-reported that he was suffering from traumatic brain injury.
That's something that is frequently underdiagnosed and underreported. People can sustain traumatic brain injuries from any number of things, including car accidents or falling off of a structure or vehicle, or being exposed to a blast injury where the shock wave from an explosion can violently shake your head back and forth and rattle your brain around inside your skull. But if you don't show enough symptoms to get screened and diagnosed at the moment, there may not be anything in your records to demonstrate that you were exposed to a traumatic brain injury. The military has been working very hard to do a better job about diagnosing traumatic brain injuries and pulling people from the fight if they have been exposed to a mild TBI to give their brain a chance to heal and recover. But there are a lot of challenges when you have a highly motivated population like soldiers who don't want to leave their comrades. So some will actually try to hide exposure to mild traumatic brain injuries and not report them because they want to be able to stay there and continue to serve alongside their comrades in arms.
Again, I'm speaking with Kayla Williams, who served in the U.S. Army for 5 years as an Arab linguist, including a year in Iraq with the 101st Airborne Division. She's a member of the Army Education Advisory Committee, a fellow at the Truman National Security Project, and a former member of the VA Advisory Committee on Women Veterans. Her books include Love My Rifle, More Than You, Young and Female in the U.S. Army, and her latest book just out is Plenty of Time When We Get Home, Love and Recovery in the Aftermath of War. So, of course, in your case, your husband had severe traumatic brain injury. He had a piece of shrapnel that went through the back of his head right through and exited out above his eye, I believe, on his forehead.
Near his right eye, yeah.
Yes. So that couldn't be more hideous. And I know when we last spoke, you said when you looked at the x-rays, you couldn't believe that anybody could survive. Obviously, this fellow Ivan Lopez didn't have anything similar to that. So how do you assess, since the brain is so mysterious, how do you assess and aggregate the degree of TBI, traumatic brain injury?
My understanding is that brain injuries are categorized by the severity of the initial injury as either mild, which is basically a concussion, moderate, or severe, and all penetrating brain injuries are automatically categorized as severe. But interestingly enough, there's so much that researchers still don't know about how the brain works. There can be tremendous variation in recovery despite the severity of the initial injury. So my husband sustained a severe brain injury penetrating that was very, very severe. The neurosurgeon thought that he would never be functionally independent, that he might never walk again, but he was walking within a couple of days, and over a period of about a decade, he regained a tremendous amount of cognitive function. It took 6 years for him to be able to read a book again cover to cover, but today he's recovered enough that he's actually started going back to college. And for people who sustain mild traumatic brain injuries or concussions, my understanding is that about 85% all of their symptoms resolve completely within a few months. But for about 15%, there can be lingering symptoms that range from memory problems to anger control problems, difficulty controlling impulses, and a variety of other things. So it's really difficult to know, based on the initial injury, how somebody's long-term prognosis might actually be. And there is also, if you followed the news about football players, American football players, there's a growing amount of evidence that repeated mild brain injuries, repeated concussions, can have a cumulative effect that's extremely deleterious.
So just turning back to Ivan Lopez, the 34-year-old specialist who'd served 4 months in Iraq and was undergoing treatment for mental health issues. He had self-reported. Apparently he was being treated with Ambien. He had sleep problems, etc. He was married with a young child living near the post in Killeen, Texas. He had served in the Puerto Rican National Guard and spent 13 months in 2007 in the Sinai Peninsula with peacekeeping units. And according to Sergeant Major Nelson Bigas of the Puerto Rican National Guard Command, that he knew Lopez during his 17 months training at Fort Hood, and later in the Sinai described him as one of the best soldiers we had in our infantry. But he's also driving a truck. Now, is that some kind of indication of any kind of demotion, or is it not to suggest that not driving a truck is a worthy occupation?
I cannot guess without having access to his personnel files, but if, as you say, he initially served in the National Guard and then switched to the regular Army, he could have chosen to change jobs when he made that switch. And I have no idea.
So,
if you switch from one type of service to another, you may choose to change jobs while making that type of change.
So, given that he was able to purchase these guns off base, he lived off base, and it's relatively easy to purchase firearms in Texas.
In America.
And in America in general, yes. And we won't get into that sad subject, but it is a little bit of a bitter irony that it's the same a gun store, Guns Galore, where Major Nidal purchased his firearm that killed 13 people a couple of years ago and wounded considerably more. What are the rules about bringing firearms onto, private firearms onto bases?
There are very strict regulations about military-owned weapons. Those are always locked up in an arms room, and I am not up on the current regulations about privately owned weapons. I'm just not aware of the current regulations on them. I did read a report a couple of years ago that I thought was interesting, saying that Congress had recently passed a law that commanders in the military were no longer authorized to talk to troops within their command and offer them the opportunity to lock up their privately owned weapons in the unit arms room if the commanders were concerned about the mental health of their troops, and that could be worth re-examining as a policy.
Well, that sounds like one of those laws that the NRA put through, you know.
It certainly does, doesn't it?
The idea that the military officer has no right to talk to subordinates about the use of their private firearms. Also, it does lead you to this extraordinary contrast between the military that has lethal weapons under lock and key and civilian outside the base. It's like a free fire zone. I mean, that's pretty bizarre, isn't it?
I mean, my family has made the decision to not keep a weapon. And as an American, I do believe that we do have a constitutional right to own firearms, but since I have two small children, it has been our decision that for the safety of our household, it is better to not have weapons in the house.
But just in general, the idea that outside of a military base, you can have weapons, you can carry them, you can conceal them, you can buy ammunition, you can buy any amount of guns, but on a military base, you have really weapons under lock and key, and yet the Congress passes a law suggesting that military commanders don't have the right to insist on their subordinates basically having oversight over their use and carrying of private firearms. I guess it's something we're going to have to look into, this business of off base and on base. But you would think, I guess you don't. Do you go? You would go through metal detectors, wouldn't you? Every time you come in and off.
No.
You don't.
No, you drive. You drive through, but a car to you can't.
Right.
You drive a car through the main installation gate, but I don't. Again, I cannot tell you what the regulations are about about privately owned weapons on bases. I don't have them memorized.
And presumably, you know, as you just pointed out, there are a lot of places on a car where you can hide a weapon. So, you know, it's not like getting aboard a plane. So I take it that this is something that is going to come out, don't you think, in the after-action reports about what happened here? It certainly sounds like this law that was passed by the Congress, removing authorities of commanders to police the use of private firearms, that might get a second look, don't you think?
I certainly think it is worth considering, especially since another problem that the military is battling is suicide, and firearms are a lethal means that are frequently used in suicide. And so being able to help remove that as a method from people who are struggling would be a potential avenue that's worth exploring.
Well, Kayla Williams, just in the last minute or so, though, I want to get back to what you said earlier about the very tenuous connection between violence and PTSD, you know, and that connection is being made that, you know, people who are suffering from PTSD, they may be violent in a minor sense amongst those, you know, in families. And I take it in your husband's long recovery, you had a number of incidents where you had to deal with his...
impulsive anger, yes.
Yes, but, you know, this cannot and should not be a kind of, an excuse or a reason for people to start making that connection, which unfortunately some in the press are doing.
Right, and I think that does a real disservice to veterans and to everyone who is struggling with mental health concerns. It is worth noting that PTSD can result from any number of traumas aside from combat. It can result from being the victim of violent crime, from being in car accidents, from experiencing natural disasters, Hurricane Katrina or something like that. So I really want to remind people that just because somebody has post-traumatic stress disorder, that does not automatically make them a threat. It is a very manageable condition with evidence-based treatment. And the other really important message to put out is that people who are struggling should seek help because there are very effective means of treatment. Veterans in crisis can call 1-800-273-TALK and press 1 for 24-hour assistance. The Veterans Crisis Line is also available online. And any of your listeners who are struggling with mental health concerns or trauma, perhaps hearing the news about this shooting has brought up traumatic memories for people. Anybody who's struggling should reach out and ask for help because there are evidence-based forms of treatment that can help, and no one should be suffering alone.
And, of course, in this case, it may be all these reports are quite misleading about PTSD. There may well be a whole other psychological profile involved in what led this Ivan Lopez to do what he did.
And we simply don't know. It's too soon to tell.
Right. But, I mean, it's fairly likely, isn't it, that there are other factors involved. If there is no evidence that he had PTSD and he self-reported, it may be a case of either misdiagnosis or not sufficient diagnosis.
I mean, I think that most people have a deep feeling that for somebody to commit a mass shooting is an indication of some profound disturbances.
Sure. Well, Kayla, just give us out that number again, you don't mind.
The Veterans Crisis Line is 1-800-273-TALK, and veterans can press 1. And definitely I would urge any of your listeners who are feeling that they're in crisis to seek help because there are effective forms of treatment and nobody should be suffering alone.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Kayla Williams.
Thank you for having me on. Have a good evening.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Kayla Williams, who served in the U.S. Army for 5 years as an Arab linguist, including a year in Iraq with the 101st Airborne Division. She's a member of the Army Education Advisory Committee, a fellow at the Truman National Security Project, and a former member of the VA Advisory Committee on Women Veterans. Her books include Love My Rifle More Than You, Young and Female in the U.S. Army, and her latest book just out is Plenty of Time When We Get Home, Love and Recovery in the Aftermath of War. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into the details of the Supreme Court's ruling in McCutcheon versus the FEC.
I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head, even if he had to wrong someone. I hope he's
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jessica Levinson, the Vice President of the Los Angeles Ethics Commission and a professor at Loyola Law School, where she focuses on election law and governance issues, including campaign finance, ethics, and state budgets. She wrote an amicus brief for the Supreme Court in McCormish versus Bennett, the case in which John Roberts and four other justices ruled to limit public funding in elections. She is the editor of the blog polawticks.blogspot.com and has an article at the Los Angeles Times, Supreme Court ruling as if we don't have enough money in politics already. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jessica Levinson.
Thank you so much for having me.
And yesterday, Jessica, I spoke with Robert Weisman, the head of Public Citizen, who's they're organizing a national protest against the McCutcheon decision. And I got some mail from listeners complaining that Weisman's claim that donors now could write a single check for $5.9 million to candidates, parties, or political committees is inaccurate. What's your understanding of that figure?
Well, my understanding is that actually the Supreme Court wasn't entirely clear on this themselves during the oral arguments in McCutcheon versus FEC. You saw them kind of banter about different numbers. The numbers that I've heard are about 3.5, 3.6 million, which essentially means that you max out on the base contributions to all candidates and all political committees that give to candidates. You know, the truth is we're talking about $2 million here or there, which I think proves the point that for the vast majority of people, and I mean 99.5% of Americans, we're not worried about whether we can give more than $120,000 to candidates total. And that's what this decision really talks about. This decision is focused on those particularly wealthy donors and what they can do with respect to total giving to candidates and committees.
So what is the limit then on the single candidate that you can donate to both in the primary and the general?
So it's $2,600 indexed for inflation. It was reset under McCain-Feingold, and that's each election, meaning primary and general elections being separate elections. People can give about $5,000 to political action committees. So there are a lot of ways to get substantial amounts of sums directly to candidates, and now you don't have to limit the number of candidates that you can give to.
But, of course, you have this vast loophole that you could, you know, drive a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier through, and that is the super PACs, these 501c4s, which don't require any attribution to who is giving the money. You can give unlimited amounts of money, and as your article in the LA Times points out, these various front groups like Restore Our Future, American Crossroads, Priorities USA, etc., spent $830 million in the 2012 elections without having to disclose their donors. So that is hardly an example of constraints on the abilities of the, 0.1 of 1% to finance elections.
Well, that's exactly right. And I think, you know, frankly, that's why a lot of people like me who believe in campaign finance restrictions or at least think that they embrace good public policy really were saying to ourselves, you know, in some ways this decision is based on which mechanism do you want people to give money to? Is it the independent groups, which, as you said, you can give unlimited sums to these groups, the groups can spend unlimited sums, or is it directly to candidates and political parties, or is it both? And I think that what this decision really embraces is it's just another example of the whittling away of any semblance of a comprehensive campaign finance scheme, which, frankly, we've never seen come to fruition in our country. But I do think, to your point, you know, a lot of people were saying, well, if I can give unlimited sums to independent expenditure groups and I don't have to necessarily disclose who I am, then what's the problem with just giving the base contributions to a lot of different candidates? How can that raise the specter of corruption or the appearance of corruption? My response to that is it absolutely can, but I think the Supreme Court has created an environment where money flows so freely throughout our political system that now anytime we have one restriction, people are saying, well, what does that one restriction do? Well, unfortunately, given the climate that the Supreme Court created, sometimes not everything. So we're in a very difficult position because of the court's decisions.
And just back to that earlier point about the Supreme Court not being exactly clear about what the limits are, could it still be that that you could write a check for $5.9 million? Or do you think that Weissman was off on that number?
So I would really want to check where Weissman got that number before I say he was certainly off, because I have a lot of respect for the work that he does.
Mm-hmm.
I know in the oral arguments, the discussion was $3.5, $3.6 million, and that's the figure that I've seen more frequently.
Well, of course, in those oral discussions that you just mentioned, Jessica Levinson, Justice Antonin Scalia said in the October hearing, quoting, "I don't think $3.5 million is a heck of a lot of money."
Right.
You know, you have to ask yourself, what planet are these guys on?
So I think that a lot of the Supreme Court's rulings do not embrace what I see is a practical, common sense, real world view of campaigns. I think there are legitimate rights and expectations on both sides of the balance when it comes to giving and spending money in politics. But in my mind, the Supreme Court just really miscalculates the pernicious influence of money and, frankly, how much money most people can spend. You know, the vast majority of people give no money. And, you know, then there are some people who give small sums to candidates that they really support. And then there are fewer people who are maxing out. And then there are even fewer people who are giving the large sums that we typically talk about in the media. And those are the people who are discussed most frequently in the Supreme Court's opinion. What we don't see in the majority opinion is a discussion of what does this mean for the speech rights of all of the other participants in our democracy, all of the other voters, all of the people who want to listen and want to speak. You know, what does giving a few people a much louder microphone mean for them?
Again, I'm speaking with Jessica Levinson, the Vice President of the Los Angeles Ethics Commission and a professor at Loyola Law School, where she focuses on election law and governance issues, including campaign finance, ethics, and state budgets. She wrote an amicus brief for the Supreme Court in McCormish versus Bennett, the case in which John Roberts and four other justices ruled to limit public spending in elections. And she's the editor of the blog polawticks.blogspot.com. And has an article at the Los Angeles Times, Supreme Court ruling as if we don't have enough money in politics already. But I find this ruling to be intensely partisan, and I do wonder, and I broached that with Robert Weissman yesterday, whether or not we are being too generous in talking about these jurists as stewards of our laws and wrapping all of these decisions in legalese, when it appears that they're basically political operatives for the Republican Party. Now, you may not agree with that, but you can't deny the fact that this case was brought to the Supreme Court by the Republican National Committee.
I think that's right, but truthfully, I think that the lifting of the aggregate contribution limits could actually help both political parties, because party leaders will be able to say, you know, you used to give to those independent groups, but now you should just give to us because we are best organized and best situated and can best get money to the candidates who need the money and can help do what you want to do, which is to get certain candidates elected. And so the truth is, I think that the Democratic Party could benefit from this decision. Of course, we don't know until we see how behavior changes. I mean, certainly the division on the court was between those justices that were appointed by Republicans and those justices that were appointed by Democratic presidents. But I think this comes down to, in a lot of ways, an ideological divide between whether you think money is speech and how corrupting you think money is in the political process. And frankly, I think it's personally very sad that it's become a partisan issue when really I think it should just be an issue of those two questions. If you think that money is speech, then it's difficult to explain why we should limit it. I don't think money is speech. I think money is money and it enables speech. And if you think that money does not have a significant corrupting potential, I think that you're not necessarily plugged into the real world, but then there's not good reasons to limit that flow of money. So I think what we have is an ideological divide that is coming down on partisan lines.
Well, but the fact of the matter is that the case was brought by the Republican National Committee, and Reince Priebus, the head of the RNC, celebrated the ruling yesterday. So the Republicans clearly think this gives them an advantage. That would be the only conclusion one could come to.
Oh, I think that's right. I mean, you know, Citizens United also was celebrated by a lot of Republicans and initially bemoaned by Democrats. But the truth is, I think Republicans are just better at raising and spending corporate money. And therefore, one can argue that the decision is a lot more beneficial for them. But when it comes to McCutcheon, you know, I actually don't know how we're going to see this play out a few election cycles from now. You know, listeners can think that I'm very naive, and you may think so as well, but I think only time will tell which political party, or whether it's both political parties, will really benefit from this decision.
Well, so far, in comparison to Reince Priebus's celebration of this ruling, Nancy Pelosi, the minority leader in the House, described the decision as really sad and a significant blow to the democratic process. Quoting, "Is this supposed to be a money war? Is this what this is? Our founders sacrificed everything, their lives, their liberty, their sacred honor for a democracy, a government of the many, not a government of the money." So she's obviously not thinking that this is going to work out well for the Democrats.
Well, I think that she's also making a statement that's consistent with her previous positions, and there's nothing wrong with that, which is that Democrats have typically been in favor of more restrictions. I think in larger numbers holding the belief that money can be a corrupting influence. But, you know, the truth is our Democratic president certainly raised huge sums of money, has not done an enormous amount to reform the electoral processes, and was, you know, the one of the first people in recent history to say, "I'm not going to take public financing." So I think that we can look at people on both sides of the aisle. Absolutely, the reaction has been from the Republican Party leadership that this is a good decision, from the Democratic Party leadership to bemoan the decision. But I think, like Citizens United, which was my first appearance, I think, on Background Briefing, we're going to have to give it a few election cycles to see how it plays out and who it most benefits.
But surely, Jessica Levinson, you can make the comparison that what this ruling does, and you mentioned how much Obama had to raise, and there's no question that raising all that money takes a lot of time. And the Senate used to work 5 days a week, and now they work barely 2 days a week because they're off in the district or at fundraisers. And fundraisers go on around the clock on Capitol Hill. So what happens is that basically our politicians spend more time raising money than they do doing the people's business. Now, if you have a fundamental ideological difference between the two parties, which you clearly have, the Democrats, even though they have their Wall Street branch of the Democratic Party, and then they have the Democratic branch of the Democratic Party, but at least in the Democratic branch of the Democratic Party, they believe in government. They would rather be doing the people's business than raising funds. I'm not sure on the other side, the Republicans, most of whom don't believe in government, are particularly unhappy that they don't do any work for the government. They basically spend all their time raising money.
Well, so I'm not sure. I mean, I will say that I'm not sure that on either side of the aisle, people who want to go to their city halls or to their county seats or to their state capitals or to D.C. really cherish the amount of time that they spend fundraising. I mean, you could say that Republicans really want to spend time trying to repeal Obamacare as opposed to spending time with donors, and that Democrats really want to spend time talking about a minimum wage than they do fundraising. So I'm not at all convinced that there are vast majorities on either side that cherish the current situation that you talk about, which is clearly one of getting on a fundraising treadmill that just never stops and does nothing essentially but speed up. And I think that it is such a pernicious system, and it really turns the voters off in such a deep way, and it makes the voters feel like politics is really just a game for people who have money. And unfortunately, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy because fewer people go to the polls. And then what we have is elections where we're seeing turnouts in the teens and the low 20s. And that is so detrimental, I think, to a representative system of government.
Well, Jessica Leveson, just in closing, though, even with the limits now of 2,600 for one candidate for the primary and 2,600 for the same candidate for the general, $5,200, who has $5,200 to give to a politician? I'd say 99% of Americans don't, or maybe 98%. I mean, you know, I once organized a fundraiser, $1,000 ahead. It was absolute agony trying to corral a bunch of people. And, you know, in this town, you do have a lot of rich people, in particularly in show business. But it was the most soul-destroying experience I've ever had, and it was a difficult experience. Even amongst rich people, prying $1,000 loose was not easy. So I just think this whole situation clearly limits the game. If you're talking about a casino in Vegas, the only people who can buy in to this casino are the super rich.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, we, you know, you give us some great perspective here, which is we're not talking about, oh, is the upper middle class going to be able to max out on their campaign contributions? What we're talking about is really the upper echelon of the upper echelon that can spend more than $120,000 a year just giving directly to candidates. And if that's the amount that you can spend, or in a two-year election cycle, if that's the amount that you can spend, you know, you're making an enormous sum every year, which is fine, but most people are not making that level of money. And so for a lot of people, this problem is just not one that they can even fathom. Unfortunately, I think the Supreme Court has created a problem that we're all beginning to fathom and will continue to do so throughout subsequent elections.
Well, Jessica Leveson, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Jessica Leveson, who's the Vice President of the Los Angeles Ethics Commission and a professor at Loyola Law School, where she focuses on election law and governance issues, including campaign finance, ethics, and state budgets. She wrote an amicus brief for the Supreme Court in McCormish versus Bennett, the case in which John Roberts and four other justices ruled to limit public funding in elections. She's the editor of the blog polawticks.blogspot.com, and has an article at the Los Angeles Times, Supreme Court ruling as if we don't have enough money in politics already. We're going to take a brief station break, and with the possible freeing of the American spy for Israel, Jonathan Pollard, we'll be speaking with the person who did the assessment of the damage that Pollard did to American intelligence.
It's the money.
I'm more important in the USA than a spy for the FBI. I'm trained to meet the criminal elite, and I seek out wherever evil resides.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Spike Bowman, who's a former intelligence officer, an international lawyer, and a recognized specialist in national security law. with extensive experience in espionage and terrorism investigations. He was most recently the Deputy National Counterintelligence Executive and, prior to that, was a Senior Research Fellow at the National Defense University. He's retired from Senior Executive Service at the Federal Bureau of Investigation, where he served successfully as Deputy General Counsel. Welcome to Background Briefing, Spike Bowman.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And the Israeli spy, Jonathan J. Pollard, has become both a bargaining chip and something of a political football now. It appears that Secretary of State Kerry offered him up, perhaps, as some suggest, out of desperation to keep the peace talks going. Apparently this is something that Netanyahu wanted to placate his right flank, but it's resulted in the Palestinians then basically saying, well, if the Israelis are going to get concessions, we want them. And then they went ahead because Israel reneged apparently on releasing Palestinian prisoners. They have then thrown a spanner in the works by signing a bunch of multilateral agreements that are considered to be deal breakers. So I'm walking you through, this Pollard appears to be, you know, whether it's his mischief in this case or not, he still appears to be a problem for a lot of people.
Yeah, this is not the first time they've suggested that maybe his release would help somehow in solving the Palestinian issues, but it's difficult for me to understand exactly how that would work.
Well, it's done the opposite, though, hasn't it?
I think so, yes. I believe it probably has.
So why then, from your experience, and you were involved with the case at the time of Pollard's arrest and trial, you were the liaison officer for the Department of Defense to the Department of Justice and the coordinator of the investigation into the damage that Mr. Pollard's spying did to the United States intelligence community.
Well, just the initial stages of that.
Right. Well, you certainly know a lot more than most of us do about what he did. And so why is it, do you think, the Israelis are going to the mat for this guy?
Well, it's kind of interesting. When Pollard was first arrested, of course, they wanted nothing to do with him. But he became sort of a folk hero in Israel, and it's become a political issue for every Israeli leader since Pollard was arrested. It's really politics at home for Netanyahu at this point.
So, do we know, is Netanyahu placating his right flank, or does he also feel passionately, as others do, that somehow this fellow is a hero and needs to be repatriated to Israel?
I think that he's placating his right flank at this point.
I see. So, but there is this feeling in Israel that somehow, because in 1985 Pollard sought asylum in Israel's embassy in Washington, but they turned him away. My recollection is that there was actually a car chase involved, wasn't there?
There was.
So just walk us through the actual events, if you can.
Well, I wasn't present at the event, but what happened was they were following Pollard. I wouldn't say it got into a high-speed chase, but there was a chase involved. He went to the Israeli embassy and went in, and they basically threw him back out.
And he, in terms of his Israeli handler, did he ever get kicked out of the country?
He wasn't kicked out of the country. I think they left quickly.
I see. Well, but my understanding is that Pollard did fairly well out of spying. It wasn't entirely because of his devotion to Israel.
I don't think it was in response to his devotion to Israel at all. He had a number of schemes at the time trying to figure out how to make money. And this just happened to be one that he fell into because a friend of his introduced him to a colonel in the Israeli Air Force. And he immediately offered to help.
But this resulted in him being paid up to $1,500 a month. Apparently, his Israeli handler bought Pollard's wife a diamond and sapphire ring, and they sent the couple on expensive holiday trips to Europe.
That's true. In fact, they met in Paris once, and at that point, Pollard began to say that he was taking a lot of risks, and you know, he might go to jail, and they said, well, what do you want? And he said, up it by 1,000 a month.
So how close was the relationship then with the handler? My understanding is that the handler was basically tasking Pollard for specific intelligence documents, and at one point Pollard didn't bring some documents, and the handler was annoyed with him.
Yes, that's true, but he brought a lot of documents, and you're correct. He was tasked for specific documents. They had a book that listed a lot of the intelligence publications that were available, and they tasked him out of that book.
So, again, I'm speaking with Spike Bowman, who is a former intelligence officer, an international lawyer, and a recognized specialist in national security law with extensive experience in espionage and terrorism investigations. He was most recently the Deputy National Counterintelligence Executive, and prior to that was a senior research fellow at the National Defense University. He's retired from senior executive service at the Federal Bureau of Investigation, where he served successfully as Deputy General Counsel. And you had an op-ed a little while back New York Times, Don't Trust This Spy. And in that op-ed, Spike Bowman, you did talk about some of the damage he did. I take it it's classified in terms of the details, but it looks as though he gave the Israelis sources and methods in terms of signals intelligence.
Yes, that's correct.
And also sold them the daily report from the U.S. Navy's 6th Fleet Ocean Surveillance Information Facility in Rota, Spain. We know from a 2001 article by Seymour Hersh, who reported that William Casey, the former director of Central Intelligence, had said that information relayed by Mr. Pollard had been traded to Russia for Jewish emigres. And also the director of Naval Intelligence apparently said that Israel had passed on information from Pollard to the Soviets. What do we know about that beyond those two sources?
I think nothing else. I never learned where Casey got his information, and the director of Naval Intelligence had some information about certain things that had been passed on to a couple of other, possibly two other countries.
So what then was the weight of Secretary of Defense at the time, Caspar Weinberger's memo that detailed the damage that had been done by Pollard, which apparently led, or at least is attributed, to the sentence? This was read in court by the to the judge.
Well, it's possible that it contributed to it. I can tell you the structure of the affidavit that Weinberger signed. It selected 19 documents that represented the totality of what we believe that Pollard had turned over to the Israelis, and it listed the type of damage that would come from exposing the type of information that each one of those 19 documents represented. I'm not convinced that the document was the reason for the life sentence, because I personally delivered that document to the judge, and he took it and made the comment, I don't think I really need to read this, but I know the government wants me to, so I will.
So what then is the arguments that Alan Dershowitz and others that have been for the longest time asking for Pollard's release here in the United States? My sense is that while in Israel there may be a clamor to have him released, I don't see the same thing over here. And certainly the op-eds recently in response to news that Secretary of State Kerry might be using or offering up Pollard as a way to save the peace talks, the editorials have not been very favorable. So there seems to be very few real defenders of Pollard here in the United States.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think most people think a spy is a spy, regardless of who he gave the information to. And in fact, you know, if anybody has paid any attention to the case, Snowden has certainly done more than Pollard did. But Pollard is probably second on the list of having exposed the most information to a foreign power.
Well, in Pollard's case, I guess you've been able to do an after-action report, right, a damage control.
Yeah, there's been several damage control reports on it. I have not been a part of those because I when I left the Navy, I went to the FBI, and most of my work there, after at least after 9/11, was in terrorism.
But in Snowden's case, I guess there is an ongoing counterintelligence investigation. I've spoken to a few people, for example, the former CIA officer Bob Baer, who covers intelligence for CNN. He believes that Snowden was recruited by the Russians back in Geneva when he was working there, when he tried to break into the computer of the Directorate of Operations, and that arguably this whole thing has been a Russian operation from the get-go, and there's no question that Putin's enjoying it, and it's the gift that keeps on giving, and most of what's been released has been damaging to U.S. national security as opposed to exposing domestic spying.
Yes, I think that's true. I don't know whether he was recruited by the Russians or not. I've heard the allegation. I'm not really convinced.
Right. Well, I haven't. Not too many people appear to be. But in terms of when you say that Snowden's done more damage, is that to say that because they don't entirely know what he's given the Russians, and that obviously he's in Russia, that they just have to change all their sources and methods, which presumably is going to cost the taxpayer billions, if not trillions?
Absolutely. It's for certain that intelligence agencies are going to have to do severe modifications in order to keep doing their work.
So, again, just to compare the two, you say that Snowden is considerably worse than the damage that Pollard's done, but surely there's a fundamental difference. Pollard did this during the height of the Cold War, did he not?
He did.
And do we know anything in terms of what repercussions have been identified, or is it just speculation on the part, as we cited the Seymour Hersh leak from DCI Casey and the Naval Intelligence head?
Yeah, and there's a lot more speculation than there is knowledge. We do know of a few things that happened. That was the result of Pollard turning over information to the Israelis. But we don't know a lot. And he, by his own admission, he turned over enough information to occupy a space 6 feet by 6 feet by 10 feet. So we really don't know everything that was turned over.
So just in terms of a personality profile, there hasn't been a lot done on Snowden except the historian at Princeton, Sean Wilentz, wrote a piece in the New Republic that suggested that he was a fairly cold-hearted libertarian based upon his transcripts of his chat rooms online, where he basically said things like, F old people, who needs Social Security, that kind of stuff. But what kind of psychological profile did you put together for, or did others put together for Pollard to figure out what motivated him?
Well, he a couple of things that came out of this. First of all, his history showed that he was a person who wanted to do great things. He told people at various times that he was a Mossad agent, that he had been captured by the Arabs and tortured. He when he was working for the Naval Intelligence, he was sent to a psychiatrist. So he was a person who just was looking for something to make him stand out, and he got the opportunity to be a standout spy. I think that was that desire plus the desire for money are the two things that really drove him.
Well, but what does that say about our counterintelligence? If he's seeing a Navy psychiatrist, and in terms of Snowden, apparently the CIA didn't notice, obviously, that he tried to break into the Directorate of Operations computers, and apparently there was a paper trail of criticism about his or suspicions being raised about his activities, but somehow that didn't stop him from getting this important job at the NSA, or at least with a contractor for the NSA.
Yeah, it does not speak well of our system. We really have to concede that it failed miserably.
So just turning back then to the today, and I believe Pollard's got about a year and a half left, does he not, on his sentence?
I believe that's correct.
So do you think that's a factor in why Kerry decided it would be okay to offer him up as a bargaining chip, if indeed that's what happened?
Well, I've never understood why Kerry does anything, but I suppose that might have had something to do with it. He is due to get out very soon. He could be paroled if he wanted to be. So it's his time is just about over.
So, but what about then charges on the part of his defenders like Alan Dershowitz and others who say that he has been given unprecedentedly harsh treatment?
Well, I think that's totally misleading. It is true that Americans who have done espionage activities on behalf of allies have received much lighter sentences than Pollard. But the enormity of the stuff that Pollard turned over is sort of what makes the argument apples and oranges. When Dershowitz and Jim Woolsey and others say that he's been unfairly treated because others like him were treated differently, frankly, for what he did, there are no others like him.
So just in closing then, Spike Berman, why did the Israelis want this kind of information, which was largely about the Soviet Union and their military and intelligence activities vis-a-vis the competition between the U.S. and the Soviet Union? It doesn't sound like a lot of it had to do with Israel.
Well, there was a lot of it that had to do with the Middle East, a lot that had to do with the way that the United States collected things. I suppose they wanted to learn how we do things. But frankly, having been an intelligence officer myself before I went to law school, I can tell you intelligence officers just want to collect information.
And so as far as the Israelis were concerned, they had an open door, like a keyhole right into the American crown jewels.
That's exactly right. And if an American had been in the same position with somebody else, we would have been asking for everything, whether it was relevant to what we were doing or not.
Well, Spike Berman, I thank you very much for joining us.
You're quite welcome. Pleasure to be here.
Again, I've been speaking with Spike Berman, who's a former intelligence officer, an international lawyer, and a recognized specialist in national security law with extensive experience in espionage and terrorism investigations. He was most recently the Deputy National Counterintelligence Executive, and prior to that was a senior research fellow at the National Defense University. He's retired from senior executive service at the Federal Bureau of Investigation, where he served successively as a Deputy General Counsel. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.